Picture this scenario, right? You're standing at the head of a conference table. Or maybe you're on a stage looking out at this packed auditorium.
Oh, I'm already stressed.
Right.
Yeah.
And you spent, days, maybe weeks, crafting the absolute perfect message. You did the research, you wrote the script. Every single word looks brilliant on paper.
Yep, the content is flawless.
Exactly. But then you start speaking. And like within 2 minutes, you can just feel it happening. People are shifting in their seats. They're checking their phones under the
It's
table.
the worst feeling.
It really is. The magic that was on your laptop screen just gets completely lost in transit.
It's honestly one of the most frustrating experiences a professional can have because you have this incredibly valuable content. I mean, an idea that could genuinely change the room, but the delivery mechanism fails.
Yeah.
The bridge between your mind and the audience's mind just collapses.
Well, welcome to today's deep dive.
Yeah.
Because we are looking at a really fascinating source that tackles this exact problem,
Yeah.
but from a rather unique angle.
Yeah, a very specific angle.
Right. It's a lecture by Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson. It's specifically Session 9, Sermon Delivery, from his series on Preaching Old Testament Narratives.
Now I know what some of you are thinking.
Yeah. If you aren't someone who preaches biblical sermons, stick with us. Because the mission of this deep dive is to extract the underlying, universal mechanics of master-level storytelling and public communication.
Totally.
Whether you're pitching a startup to venture capitalists, trying to persuade a skeptical boardroom, or just, wanting to tell a better story at a dinner party, this is about delivering a message so effectively that your audience is genuinely wowed.
Because the stakes of human communication are pretty much the same regardless of the venue, Dr. Mathewson actually uses this analogy right at the end of his lecture that perfectly frames our goal today.
Oh, the Christmas present one.
Yes. He compares delivering a message to shipping a Christmas present across state lines. Like, it does not matter how beautiful or expensive or thoughtful the gift inside the box
If the
is.
box is crushed, it's ruined.
Exactly. If you don't pack it correctly and it gets crushed in transit, the entire effort fails. So today is really about analyzing the bubble wrap, the tape, and the shipping logistics of human speech.
Okay, let's unpack this. Pun intended, I guess, because if we want to become captivating communicators, Dr. Mathewson insists that the very first step is also, well, the most terrifying.
Dropping the security blanket.
Yes, you have to leave your manuscript and ideally all of your notes completely behind.
Which induces an immediate physiological stress response for like 90% of public speakers. The instinct is to cling to the paper.
For dear life.
Right. But he argues that notes inherently prevent eyeball-to-eyeball communication. Every time you break eye contact to look down, you're severing that interpersonal connection with the room.
You're basically signaling that your relationship with the paper is more important than your relationship with them in that moment. And he illustrates how terrifying this can be with this cautionary tale about a guy named George Truett. He was this prominent pastor at First Baptist Church in Dallas. And one day, he decides he's going to try speaking without notes.
Bold move.
Right. So he gets up in front of his congregation, starts speaking on the phrase, "You are the light of the world," and everything goes great for exactly 7 minutes.
Oh no! I know where this is going.
Yeah. His mind goes completely inexplicably blank. He just stands there in silence, looks at the crowd, and famously says, "My little light went out."
I mean, that is the ultimate public speaking nightmare realized, just standing there with nothing.
It is. But what's crucial here is how Dr. Mathewson counters that fear. He leans on a principle from another communication expert, Haddon Robinson, who said, "A good sermon remembers itself."
Or a good story remembers itself.
Exactly. I always think of it through the lens of casual conversation. Like if you're telling a friend about some harrowing escape you had while hiking or the chaotic birth of your child, you don't pause the story to pull an index card out of your pocket,
Right. You don't check your bullet points.
You just tell it. You're so immersed in the material that the details naturally trigger one another. But taking that from the living room to a high-stakes environment is tough.
It's a huge leap.
Yeah. Because reading from a manuscript feels like reading a Wikipedia page to an audience. It's perfectly accurate, but it's totally lifeless.
Yeah, no energy.
But ditching the notes feels like telling a buddy about a car crash you just witnessed. Visceral, urgent, but maybe a bit messy. So how do we actually get over that George Truett fear of our mental light just switching off?
Well, the transition requires a fundamental shift in how you view the act of speaking itself. When you rely on notes, your brain is trying to execute this highly specific sequence of vocabulary words. It's a rigid tightrope walk.
One wrong step and you fall.
Exactly.
Oh.
But when you trust the narrative flow of a story, your brain is simply moving from one major conceptual room to the next. Dr. Mathewson argues you have to stop micromanaging the vocabulary.
Stop worrying about the exact words.
Right. And start focusing entirely on the major movements of the message. And that requires a very specific, almost counterintuitive method of preparation.
Which brings us to what we could call the architecture of internalization. Because if we are throwing away our physical notes, we definitely need a psychological safety net.
For sure.
And the source material makes a massive distinction here, that internal safety net is not memorization.
What's fascinating here is how this aligns with how our brains actually process information under pressure. Rote memorization is actually the enemy of engaging storytelling.
Yeah, he says the very first step is to write out a word-for-word manuscript. Because, as he puts it, writing is a way of thinking.
It forces clarity.
Exactly. But then he explicitly warns you to never, ever try to memorize that manuscript. He says if you try to memorize your talk, you completely destroy the conversational tone.
Yeah, because when you memorize, you're storing that information in a really rigid, linear pathway in your brain. Under the adrenaline of public speaking, if you miss one single word like an and or the, that entire track derails.
And you get that blank George Truett moment.
Right. So instead of memorization, Dr. Mathewson points to the biblical definition of the word meditate. He draws from texts like Joshua 1.8 and Psalm 1.2.
And in that original context, meditating doesn't mean like sitting in silence on a yoga mat.
No, not at all. It basically means going over and over and over the text. Deep, structural immersion.
He even suggests this technique where you turn the major movements of your narrative into prayer requests. And even in a totally secular context, the underlying mechanism there is brilliant.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you're taking these dry concepts from your presentation and you're attaching emotional weight to them. You're internalizing the structure by tying it to your core desires.
Yes, and then he says you have to rehearse, but not just reviewing the concepts silently at your desk.
You have to go into an empty room and practice out loud, right? Section by section.
Exactly. The physical act of speaking the words out loud paves multiple conceptual pathways in your brain. You're basically teaching your mouth how to find the ideas naturally.
Without needing a script. Though he does offer a compromise for people who absolutely feel they must use notes, he says you can put one-word triggers in the margin of your text.
Just a single word.
Yeah. But he includes this highly specific and honestly pretty funny visual warning. He says, do not try to reproduce your manuscript in the margins by packing the text, quote, tighter than a German sausage.
I love that because when speakers panic during prep, they tend to cram tiny, illegible text into the margins as a crutch.
Yeah, a size 4 font.
Exactly. And when you're on stage, looking down at a dense block of tiny handwriting, it just completely short-circuits your brain.
Let me push back on that one-word trigger idea, though. Because say you're delivering a major pitch, and you write the word boat in the margin of your slide deck as your only trigger.
Okay.
Isn't there a massive risk that you look down, see the word boat, and your adrenaline-soaked brain simply fails to connect the dot? Like you just stand there wondering why you wrote boat.
That is a very common fear, but this is precisely where that empty room rehearsal process does the heavy lifting.
Okay, how so?
If you merely wrote boat next to a script you were trying to memorize, it would totally fail. But because you've deeply internalized the concepts, moving from a full manuscript to just the core ideas that trigger functions differently.
It's not a memory test anymore.
Right. The word boat is no longer a vocabulary quiz. It's a doorway to a room you have already walked through a dozen times out loud. The conversational pathway is already fully paved in your mind.
Oh, that makes the distinction between memorizing and internalizing incredibly clear. The trigger is just unlocking a door you've already built.
Exactly.
He also notes that during this rehearsal phase, transitions are worth their weight in gold because you've been marinating in this material for hours, but the audience is hearing it for the very first time.
They need those bridges built for them.
Right, to follow you from one conceptual room to the next.
And once that internal architecture is built and the words feel genuinely conversational, the next challenge is your physical presence. It has to align with that internalized narrative.
Yes, stepping into the scene. The source material dives into first-person narrative preaching, like teaching the Book of Ruth by speaking from the perspective of an elder in Bethlehem. He notes that this inherently forces the speaker out of a lecturing posture and into pure storytelling.
Which is so much more engaging.
Definitely. And for anyone wanting to dive deep into that specific technique, he recommends a book called It's All in How You Tell It by Torrey and Haddon Robinson. But what I found really fascinating was his philosophy on visual elements.
The props versus costumes debate.
Yeah. He draws a very sharp line between costumes and props. Even though ancient biblical prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel used elaborate costumes, Dr. Matheson personally avoids them.
Yeah, he views costumes as crossing the boundary from communication into theatrical acting. A costume fundamentally changes the identity of the speaker, which can actually alienate an audience that's just looking for authentic connection.
Props, however, are a different story, as long as you adhere to the rule of less is more. He mentions bringing a real sword on stage when teaching the narrative of Ehud, just to show the physical difference between a dagger and a sword. Or using a stick with a flag attached for Exodus 17, the Lord is my banner.
You could use broken pottery, an animal jawbone, whatever fits.
These physical objects ground abstract stories in tangible reality. But he highlights a severe danger here, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Props can very easily go rogue. They possess the power to just hijack the audience's attention entirely.
Right, like if you bring a massive shiny broadsword onto a stage, half the audience might spend the rest of the presentation wondering where you bought it, or if it's sharp.
Or if you're going to drop it.
Yeah. They walk away remembering the cool sword and completely forget the point you were trying to make. The tool overshadows the narrative.
Which is exactly what you don't want.
And speaking of physical objects getting in the way, he targets the most ubiquitous prop in all of public speaking. The podium.
Yes. Charles Spurgeon famously called the pulpit or podium a coward's castle.
I love that phrase.
It's so good. Dr. Matheson points to communicators like Ray Stedman, who intentionally moved out from behind the pulpit to deliver his messages. He quotes Don Senoukian, who bluntly stated, "There is absolutely no communication advantage to standing behind a wooden box."
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Where is the line between maintaining professional authority and turning into a theater act?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. If you abandon the podium, wander around the stage, start pulling real swords or broken pottery out of your briefcase, how do you prevent yourself from becoming the corporate equivalent of a prop comic?
It really comes down to analyzing the function of the object. The philosophy here is that the tool, whether it's your movement, a physical prop, or the removal of your notes, it must serve the narrative. It can never be the focal point.
But it has to have a clear purpose.
Exactly. The moment the audience is more impressed by the novelty of the object than they are moved by the truth of your message, you've crossed from communication into mere entertainment.
The podium is a barrier. So removing it removes friction. But a distracting prop creates friction.
Right. The focus must remain steadfastly on the clarity of the message.
Which transitions us beautifully into how we utilize the ultimate tool we bring on stage, our own bodies.
Yes.
Because even if you don't have a single prop, your physical position in the room is constantly broadcasting signals. You're acting as a spatial map for the listener.
And spatial awareness is arguably the most underrated yet psychologically powerful communication skill a speaker can develop. It provides the audience with a subconscious visual structure.
He lays out some incredibly practical mechanics for this. Let's start with movement. The rule is simple. You can move from point A to point B. You can even deliver your lines while making that walk.
But once you arrive at point B,
you must stay put. Pacing back and forth like a caged animal is visually exhausting for the audience.
Yeah.
The only exception is if you're intentionally acting out a specific character, like a king anxiously pacing in his palace.
He really expands on this by emphasizing the need to establish designated spots on the stage.
Right. Like if you're teaching the Book of Ruth, you establish one physical location on the stage to represent Moab and another distinct location for Israel. Or if you're teaching 1 Samuel, one spot belongs to King Saul, the other to the prophet Samuel.
This is where we have to translate this for the listener's everyday life, I think. Think about how this applies to a boardroom pitch.
Oh, it applies perfectly.
You could designate stage left as the old broken way of doing things. Every time you talk about legacy software, high costs, or industry failures, you physically stand in that spot.
Visual anchor.
Exactly. Then you designate stage right as the innovation. Every time you discuss your new product, you walk to that specific spot. But you cannot mix them up.
No. If you start talking about your shiny new product while standing in the broken legacy spot, the audience's brain will register a subconscious disconnect.
It's so subtle, but so important. But the most mentally demanding aspect of this spatial mapping is what Dr. Matheson calls the backwards map.
This concept requires total mental gymnastics. It really does. He points out that the audience sees everything backward relative to the speaker. If you have a mental map of the Middle East in your head, and you're explaining how someone traveled from Jerusalem to Babylon, your natural instinct is to point in the direction that feels accurate to your own body.
Right, but to the audience, you're effectively standing behind the map. Your east is their west.
So the speaker must mirror the geography. You have to point in the opposite direction so the visual tracks correctly for the listener's perspective.
It's tricky.
I immediately thought of taking a group fitness class. The instructor is facing the room, and they say, okay, reach with your left arm, but they're actually reaching with their right arm so that they mirror the class.
Yeah, exactly like that.
Having to do that level of physical mirroring while delivering an unscripted presentation sounds incredibly difficult.
It is, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, the backwards map is the ultimate exercise in empathy. It forces the speaker to become entirely audience-centric.
You're abandoning your perspective for theirs.
Literally. Mm-hmm. You are adopting their physical perspective for the sake of absolute clarity. It requires intense practice, much like his advice on physical gestures.
Oh, right. The rule for gestures is to exaggerate them significantly. Mm-hmm. Because what feels like a massive theatrical movement to you on stage looks incredibly small to the audience, especially if you're being recorded on video.
You really have to fully commit.
He says, toss imaginary wheat with a pitchfork, draw back a heavy bowstring, shield your eyes from the blazing sun. You have to embody the scene.
Yeah.
And that embodiment extends directly to eye contact.
Yeah, Haddon Robinson, who we mentioned earlier, noted a harsh reality here. Congregations simply will not listen to a speaker who does not look at them.
You have to talk with your audience, not over them.
And that distinction is a really common pitfall. To alleviate anxiety, speakers will often find a spot on the back wall and just stare at it.
Just glaze over.
Yeah, they maintain the posture of someone looking at the crowd, but they are completely avoiding the psychological weight of actual eye contact.
But Dr. Mathewson is clear. You need to look specific people directly in the eye. The only time you're allowed to gaze off into the distance is as a highly strategic gesture, like signifying a character is deep in thought.
You can't just gaze into space because you're searching your brain for your next sentence.
Right. So we've built the internal architecture, mapped the physical space, exaggerated the body, secured eye contact. But there is a final, highly nuanced layer to delivering this package intact, the auditory landscape. Exactly. It's not just the words you choose, it's the music of how you deliver them. We're talking about the power of vocal friction.
Vocal variety is the antidote to the monotone drone that kills so many presentations. Dr. Mathewson breaks this down into three specific levers: pitch, volume, and rate.
He urges speakers to go high and low with their pitch to convey different emotional states. You get loud to command authority, then drop to a soft whisper to draw people in.
Though he gives a critical technical tip here. Even when you drop your volume to a whisper, you still have to project the air behind that whisper.
So the person in the last row can actually hear the articulation.
Exactly.
And then there's rate. Speeding up the delivery to mimic the anxiety of an action sequence and slowing down significantly to let heavy, profound moments land.
What's essential to understand about these vocal levers is the psychology of contrast. A sudden drop in volume forces the audience to physically lean forward. It literally changes their posture.
And a rapid increase in rate can elevate their heart rate.
Yes. But just like physical gestures, the speaker's perception of this audio contrast is an illusion.
Yeah, he points out that you might feel like you're dropping your volume from a level 9 down to a dramatic level 2. It feels huge in your own head.
Yeah.
But to the audience, it usually only registers as dropping from a 6 to a 4.
You really have to push the contrast much further than feels natural.
But of all the vocal tools discussed, the most powerful one is not a sound at all.
It is the strategic use of silence.
Dr. Mathewson tells this story about a friend of his who is a phenomenal, buttery smooth communicator. Incredibly polished, never stumbles. But a speech expert observed him and offered a really surprising critique.
You need more roughness in your delivery.
Right, because being too smooth, delivering this continuous stream of words with absolutely no pauses, is like walking on a slippery floor.
Mm-hmm.
The audience cannot get any traction.
When a speaker never pauses, the listener's working memory buffer begins to overflow.
They just can't keep up.
Their mind is constantly slipping forward, desperately trying to process the last sentence while simultaneously trying to hear the current one. Without silence, the brain has no time to file the information.
So what does this all mean for us? Because when I read that slippery floor analogy, I instantly recognized my own worst habit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I tend to get deeply excited about the material, my adrenaline spikes, and I just turn into an absolute fire hose of information. How does a speaker actively practice silence when their fight or flight response is screaming at them to fill the dead air?
It requires immense discipline and, honestly, a complete reframing of what silence actually does. A two-second pause feels like an eternity of agonizing dead air to the person on stage.
It feels like you're failing.
Right. But to the listener, it's cognitive friction. It's giving them an emotional breath. It is the necessary resting place for their brain to actually process the profound thing you just said.
Silence is the soil where the idea takes root.
Perfectly said.
Well, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground today extracting Dr. Mathewson's insights. We started by confronting the terrifying necessity of ditching our notes to communicate eyeball to eyeball.
The George Truett nightmare.
Exactly. Then we learned to build an internal architecture by meditating on our core concepts, rather than falling into the rigid trap of robotic memorization. We stepped out from the coward's castle of the podium, learned to map our physical space with exaggerated gestures in the backwards map.
And finally, we explored the cognitive friction of silence.
All of these mechanisms serve a single, unified purpose, right? Ensuring the message survives the journey from your mind to theirs.
Think back to that core takeaway, your startup pitch, your boardroom presentation, your dinner party story. It is a Christmas present shipped across state lines.
And all this prep is the bubble wrap.
Yes. The vocal variety, the spatial mapping, the empty room rehearsals that is your bubble wrap and shipping tape. It's doing the hard work to ensure the package arrives exactly as you intended, so your audience is genuinely wowed by the gift inside.
Take these tools and actively apply them the next time you have to stand up and deliver an idea.
You know, we spend so much time obsessing over the exact right words to say to win people over, but think about the most memorable conversations of your life.
Right.
Is it the words you remember, or is it the space between the words? The eye contact, the physical presence, the silence that actually made you feel something? Next time you have to communicate something vital, what if you spent as much time practicing the silence as you do the script?